Thank you very much, Professor Hirschleifer, for this illuminating and succinct presentation of a great body of complicated ideas. Our next speaker is Professor Roger Masters of Dartmouth College. Professor Masters' career has been at Dartmouth, almost completely at Dartmouth, and Dartmouth did what few universities do, or colleges, and honored him with an honorary master's degree. To be honored in your own school is a distinctive honor indeed. He served as United States cultural attaché in France, and he is the author of the best book dealing with the political theory of Rousseau in existence. Professor Masters is going to speak to us on sociobiology and conservatism.
Time for discussion, since I have a very profound feeling that the democratic process is indeed naturally superior to others, but it requires the exchange of different perspectives. I'll try and explain a little bit what I mean. I want to first begin by pointing out why it is that sociobiology is not a political theory, that is, that it is not biased in advance. So that if we try and see the relationship between this particular theory and conservatism, it cannot be claimed that it is an utterly circular set of propositions. Sociobiology is the science of the nature of social behavior, and Jack has presented, I think, a very clear introduction to it. The basic principles of sociobiology, therefore, can be understood as an answer to Mitch Dechter's excellent statement of a fundamental problem of our time, so what? Sociobiology provides us with a theory of how it could be that other animals and ourselves behave together. It provides us with such a theory that can claim to have scientific answers. It begins from the notion that natural selection is concerned with reproductive success, that is, the fitness of an individual collection of genes as being determined by that individual organism's capacity to leave behind offspring. This is, of course, very wounding to our pride, since it leads to the view that the hen is the egg's way of making another egg. We don't like thinking of ourselves in that way. It wounds our pride, as I say, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. As Jack has pointed out, sociobiology provides a cost-benefit theory of cultural forms of behavior or cultural evolution. It provides us with natural laws of human behavior, as of the behavior of other animals, on the assumption that individuals can be counted on to behave in the long run in ways that are profitable to them or to their genes, that is, in ways that maximize the profit or the benefit compared to the cost, something we all know from economics. Now, different forms of social behavior can be, under different circumstances, beneficial. And Jack has outlined very clearly the three forms, which I sometimes describe as nepotism or selfishness, competitiveness, mutual benefit connected with the whole notion of privacy and private property, and altruism or sharing. When we see that variety of possible behaviors, however, it is very easy to conclude that since there is a wide variety of human responses, there is nothing but relativism, that the behavior that any one individual or group chooses is a matter of purely arbitrary custom, and so what? That, however, is precisely, I believe, what sociobiology teaches us is an inadequate view. On the contrary, I think sociobiology is a return to the view that some things are right according to nature in precisely the sense that that was understood by Aristotle. And I think increasingly myself that this field shows us that a work like the Ethics of Aristotle, or Plato's Republic, are works that are simply true. That the philosophic works in the Western tradition, particularly in the Socratic version of that tradition, are indeed scientifically defensible, and they are not merely poetic values in some wishy-washy sense. But that gives rise immediately to a terrifying problem, because we know perfectly well that different human societies have differed in their standards. What natural selection theory shows us, however, is that those differences are all results of the same fundamental principles. Adaptation to varied environmental circumstances will indeed produce different social responses. Animals known as woodchucks seem to be utterly selfish. If you read Robert Frost's poem, The Drumlin Woodchuck, you have a beautiful poetic insight into a kind of animal that at the slightest threat to its individual safety hides without giving care to warning others. But very closely related species, the Olympic marmot, behaves in a highly social pattern. And the reason for both of those behaviors is the same, namely that they are natural responses to that pervasive and fundamental need, namely reproductive success to perpetuate the species. What I'm suggesting is that in the study of human behavior and other animal behavior, as in other sciences, we find a difference between relativism, which is just arbitrary fiat, so what, and relativity, which is to say, in given circumstances, a particular response is indeed natural and right. It's very easy to say that since one man's meat is another man's poison, well, everything is a matter of personal taste. Sociobiology teaches us there is a kind of, if you want, a special theory of relativity of human behavior. We can say why parent-child offspring now have conflicts, why parents disagree with their children, or why there's sibling rivalry, or why sometimes individuals help each other, why there is food sharing in our species and not in other primates. It's very easy to say, well, one culture's delight is another culture's taboo, and therefore it doesn't matter, it's just a matter of arbitrary preference. But I think sociobiology teaches us there's a kind of general theory of relativity, that customs are not arbitrary. Now, this leads me to raise the question, well, what are the political implications of such a theory? And I suggest, as indeed I think Jack did, that they are not simply conservative or simply radical, as that is often understood. On the one hand, such a theory has many radical or at least unsettling implications. It suggests, for example, that there are scientific explanations for matters which are often discussed in terms of religious faith. That's a very unsettling and radical thing, and I think always was, clearly was for Darwin. This is a theory which leads us to question, and I think ultimately reject, the notion that there is an absolute and fixed natural law that is true in all times and in all places without regard to circumstances. Aristotle, who certainly was no relativist, insists that that which is right according to nature changes under certain circumstances. And I think that is true. And I think that is very unsettling to us. I think, above all, there is a very radical implication, the principle of natural equality. That is the notion that each of us as an organism simply is the mechanism by which a constellation of genes and chromosomes is perpetuating a species into a natural continuum, and that none of us has any right to arrogate an attempt to wipe out other such individuals, but rather a certain humble acceptance of the notion of difference and equal opportunity. That's a very, very radical idea. I think it was radical at the time when Jefferson penned the Declaration of Independence, and it remains radical. But there are clearly some very conservative implications, as conservative is understood in our tradition. First, the wisdom of traditions. The wisdom of the view of Aristotle that our species is a zoon politikon, a social species, however we compete with each other. The wisdom of viewing those traditions which have emerged over time, as Burke does, as responses that aren't fiddled with in some bureaucratic, trivial manipulation, as if human beings are blank sheets of paper. That's a conservative idea, and it is naturally very sound from this perspective. Secondly, I think that there is a fundamental sense of a certain primacy of the individual, not in any absolute or rigid sense, but in the sense that since each individual naturally seeks to perpetuate himself and his genes, or herself and her genes, the community as such cannot claim, as I think Jack pointed out, to obliterate those different responses of different individuals in a way that some programmed societies have thought of creating a new man or a new woman fit for a new and perfect utopia on Earth, a brave new world. And this leads to a third notion, a notion which I think is easy to connect to sociobiology and the Western tradition, the notion that the omnipotent state could be the most terrifying danger to the nature of the species. Brave New World is now possible. It's the task of our generation and the generation, the immediately following generation, to decide whether we will have it or not. But it is materially present in the scientific technologies, and I think sociobiology teaches us that such an attempt to control the gene pool would be of the most awesome danger, since it would take in one generation's supposed hubris the risk that one knew how to control evolution for all time in the future, which I think is a horrifying prospect. So that I think in terms of the political implications of this teaching, the main thing one can see is that you have the possibility fully, for the first time in the last several centuries, of a science of human social behavior, but one which does not conclude that what is always right. That is to say, one can determine some standards of behavior which are not simply matters of accepting conventional variations as arbitrary matters. Having a science of what is right by nature, in other words, does not mean that we must accept everything that we see in the world any more than having a science of medicine means that when you get appendicitis, you can't have an appendectomy. Let me look very quickly at three concepts of conservatism, therefore, in the light of this theory. In so doing, I hope I will generate a little bit of healthy controversy. The first view of conservatism is that of conserving political principles. The second is the view of conservatism as conserving individual wealth. And the third is conservatism as conserving the environment. First, conserving political principles. I'd like to suggest that sociobiology teaches us the wisdom of the American political traditions that I think we all share. As Jack has pointed out, sociobiology teaches us that nepotism, that is the attempt to compete with others and to transmit those benefits to one's offspring, and above all, the fundamental principle that each human being is by nature equal in that competitive situation, that indeed is natural. We need not be ashamed anymore to say that all men are naturally equal is scientifically true. We need not be ashamed of that. Now that leads us, I think, to realize that the notions of individualism, of the market economy for exchanging goods and services, and local self-government have an enormous benefit. They are reasonable and prudent. Above all, I would insist that the notion of democracy follows quite necessarily from the view that different individuals have different perceptions of complex reality and that there's no one individual who has a secret inside track on the truth. It's a very profound and humbling realization to sense that one's own cultural tradition can, for the first time in really quite some time, claim to be really true, better for human beings. We don't have to fool around with that a lot. So let me turn to the second notion of conservatism, conserving individual wealth. Because here I think we see something very interesting and perhaps much more controversial. I know Jack and I have had some very interesting set-tos on this one. It seems to me that sociobiology leads one to assume that individuals will try to maximize their reproductive success, that is, the chance that their offspring will in turn have offspring who will have offspring. That leads to a tendency of human beings to seek to pass on the benefits that they acquire to their offspring. However, if that tendency is too successful, it chokes off the competitive opportunities in the next generation. I think there is a structural difference between upward and downward social mobility, which is one of the great problems of all civilizations. If you say to someone, I believe in social mobility, particularly liberals, they always think it's upward mobility. Well, of course, it doesn't take much reflection to indicate that if you can't have upward mobility without downward mobility, or everybody is president. It's very hard to have 220 million presidents all at once. Tocqueville warned us that this was the fundamental problem of Western civilization in general, and Tocqueville saw in our regime the unique situation, at least in his time, of a society where people tolerated downward mobility as the reward for incompetence. It seems to me that every bit of data I can see on social structure indicates that what destroyed the Ancien Régime, namely the slow accumulation over generations of the residue of that nepotistic, probably natural tendency to try and help one's offspring, generating more and more incompetence at the top of a society and finally bringing down that society, that's a real danger. I may be one of the few people in this room who thinks that a depression would be good for this country. Now, that's a very strange argument, but I think it suggests that we must confront directly the contradiction between the conservation of our principles and the conservation of our individual wealth and the transmission of that wealth untouched to incompetent grandchildren. If we take seriously the notion, in other words, of equal opportunity, we have to take seriously the notion that our grandchildren will fail. And without the possibility of failure, there can be no real success. The third issue I want to deal with is another issue of conservation, conserving the environment. And I think it, too, has to do with the question of how we live with nature and with our own nature, and the extent to which we are willing to seek our own short-term benefit, which is a natural enough tendency, at the cost to others. And again, I want to talk about the cost to our great-grandchildren. It seems to me that the natural tendency to seek self-interest, competition, benefits we can pass on to our children, lead us, among many circumstances, to produce in systems of private economies mutually beneficial agreements, but there are sometimes participants who are not present in those mutually beneficial agreements. I think of the problem of pollution as a very serious one. It's known technically in the literature as the tragedy of the commons. Why is it that a large number of individually acting agents, fishermen seeking lobsters, herdsmen grazing on the common, firms producing in the industrial system, why is it that a large number of individual actors occasionally destroy some collective resource without which the entire system cannot survive? This is, of course, another way of saying that there is an element of virtue, civic virtue, social virtue, by which every civilization must stand or fall. And it seems to me that if one looks at the fate of every previous civilization, what we see is the fall of those civilizations. And I think the fall is connected with earth and water, the natural elements on which we must all depend, and which we tend to overexploit. We tend to overexploit them because there are short-term benefits, and we have great difficulties imagining why we should limit our short-term benefits for a long-term gain, which others, free riders, can harvest as well as we if we restrain our use of those collective resources while they do not. I'm dealing, in other words, with the issue of why should it be that during a water shortage in California, when the water table is going down progressively, individuals compete with their neighbors to see who can have the greenest lawn by watering their grass in complete ignorance or defiance of the suggestions that there will soon be no water left for the community. I'm dealing with the question, why should it be that Saudi Arabia is today a desert when it was once green? Every prior civilization has had this difficulty that we could describe, I suppose, as the problem of the Love Canal. And I submit to you that if conservation does not include some notion of a commitment to preserve nature for our great-grandchildren, based on a notion of having a commitment to check our own selfish needs for comfort in this generation for the benefit of those yet to come. Our civilization has no future. So I conclude quickly, because I want, I think, to give some room for discussion, with the notion that these three elements of conservatism, conserving political principles, conserving individual wealth, and conserving the environment, take on, I think, a rather different light than we often believe from the perspective of sociobiology as a science of human behavior. In the first place, it seems to me that conserving our political principles needs necessarily to be looked at for the first time in terms of the relationship between politics and scientific analysis of human behavior. There is, I think, abroad a widespread fear of science, and such a fear of science has led us increasingly to inhibit the investment of our institutions of government in science and education. That's a tremendously dangerous thing. It's a tremendously dangerous thing when a civilization does not invest in pure science without knowing whether it will be practical in the next 15 minutes. And the fear of science, which is abroad in many areas in the land, I think, is something that can paradoxically undermine the very American traditions which will be strengthened, if I am correct, by a deeper understanding of the natural principles of social behavior. Secondly, I think we have a problem of the survival of the species and of the country and of the Western tradition that arises from the obstacles to social mobility, which are natural enough, but which our tradition has wisely tried to undercut with a principle of equal opportunity, free competition, and therefore the legitimacy of failure. And if we try and extend that safety net to prevent the failures and the discomforts that each of us would like to avoid because we know on a private level it permits us, if we prevent that kind of failure, we're unable to pass on money to our great-grandchildren or something like that. If, in other words, we sacrifice the long-term benefits of social mobility for the short-term benefits of selfishness, our society is in trouble. And the third, and from, to my mind, the critical, most critical of all, is that awesome question of will we limit those mutually beneficial activities in the market economy in the name of that element of civic virtue which will leave behind some kind of natural environment for our great-grandchildren. That, it seems to me, has always been part of the deepest tradition of conservatism in the West. I certainly think, for instance, very striking when I reflected, as I was coming to Chicago, on Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt, I suppose, would have to go down as somebody who was not a flaming liberal or a Marxist. And yet Teddy Roosevelt had a different kind of conservatism, it seems to me, from one which we see abroad in the land today. And I hope I can get a good conversation going on something like Mr. Watt, who I do not consider a conservative at all. I consider him a very dangerous man. And I consider him a dangerous man because I consider that he is undermining the possibility that this country will survive as a society where there is a decent and wholesome natural environment for your grandchildren and mine. Questions?